Okay, as I said, Genesis chapter 29 tonight. So one of the interesting things about this chapter is just how much time elapses in the course of just one chapter. So if anybody wants to do some quick math in your head and figure out how much time passes in chapter 29, approximately. That's a good round estimate, yeah. About 20 years, Celeste says. Anybody want to get maybe a little more specific? I would call it 18. So you've got the marriage of Rachel and Leah, right? And how many years does he serve for each one of them? All right, 7 plus 7 is 14. And then at the end of the chapter, you've got the recording of his first four children being born, right? Well, let's just say a year per child, if you're going just about as fast as possible, which it seems like they probably were, then that's add 4 years. So 14 plus 4 is 18. Now, if there was some more time, then sure, you know, if we just went around and call it 20 years. That's a good bit of time that passes just in this one chapter. And then we also don't know, I mean, plus a month at the beginning from the time that he gets to Haran and meets with Laban, and then text says that he stays with him for a month before this question is asked of, you know, what are your wages going to be, and he asks for Rachel's hand. So there's another month that we can add. It's the Bible narrative for you, though, right? I mean, things just kind of, they move. They move along very quickly. And so that's what we're going to be dealing with here in this chapter here today, of course, is the marriage of Jacob to both Leah and Rachel. All right, so question number one, where did Jacob go when he arrived? Okay, to a well. Now, did he necessarily know where he was? Probably not. I mean, it's not like he had a map with him or something. He's probably just following the road, not sure exactly where he's at. But he asks, you know, hey, like, who are you, basically, to the shepherds? And do you know of, have you ever heard of Laban, the son of Nahor? And so they say yes. And so he's like, okay, well, I guess I'm in the right place. And so when he comes to this well, why do you think he decides to stop at the well? Okay, he's probably thirsty. It's hot. He's traveling. And it's a gathering place. It's where he would have found shepherds. And he knows that about his family, probably, that they are shepherds. And this, if he's going to find them, this is going to be a good place, or at least to find somebody that knows them. And so it's a logical place for him to stop. He figured he could find or at least get word of his family here. All right, question number two. Note similarities to how a wife was found for Isaac. Huh? Yeah, same basic scenario, right? Finds them at a well. They're watering their flocks. He is sent to his family. He asks them some questions, and then they ran and told Laban. All of those things happen in both instances. Now, yes, there are some differences. Obviously, with Isaac, it was Abraham's servant that was sent. Here, Jacob goes personally. And then in the story of Isaac, of the servant going to find a wife for Isaac, that servant had stopped and prayed multiple times, it seems, along the way, had a very specific plan of action of what he was going to do, asked God for a sign to confirm that this is the specific wife, and it seems like Jacob had not gone to those kinds of specifics in order to ask a sign from God. Remember what we talked about last week, which was that it doesn't really seem yet at this point that Jacob has kind of really developed his faith to the point where Abraham and Isaac had been, and so it kind of makes sense that he wouldn't have maybe had the faith still at this point to ask for those kind of specific signs from God and to have that kind of a plan of action to be that kind of a praying man at this point in his life. Yeah. Why is he going in the first place? He's on the run. Exactly, yeah. He's just doing what his mom told him to. And I think we're going to see also in chapter 30 that Jacob still isn't quite the praying man that he ought to be. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and he's going to be going through a very huge maturing process over the next 4 or 5 chapters as we read. And he's going to go through a lot of things. I think God was developing him through these experiences. Yeah, yeah, exactly, just like Abraham and Isaac. Okay, so question number 3, about whom did Jacob inquire and what did the people answer him? Okay, about Laban, what did they say? Yes, we know him, and it is well with him. And then they said, what? And look, here comes his daughter, Rachel, coming with the sheep. And, of course, what's interesting about the fact that Rachel is coming with the sheep? Yeah, she was a shepherdess. It wasn't one of the sons. It wasn't a servant or a worker. It was Rachel herself was out there as a shepherdess with the sheep, which I think says something about her, her character, her willingness to work, her even bravery, if you will, dealing with wild animals or whatever that might be out there trying to attack. Doing the job of a shepherd or shepherdess was no easy task. And her name actually means you. As like a ewe lamb, so kind of appropriate, as tends to be with Bible names all the time, right? Okay, so he meets Rachel there, and then let's see what happens. Then he says, like, "Hey, why aren't you? You're basically not where you're supposed to be right now. Why are you gathered here at the well in the middle of the day when you should be out, at the pasture?" And they say, "Well." What reason did they give? Yeah, we're waiting for everybody to get here. So basically, all the shepherds in the area would water their flocks at the same time. And it seems like, possibly, why would they do that? Okay, there's a big stone that covers the well. So maybe they had to have multiple people to open it up. I don't know. But for whatever reason, this was their normal practice was to wait for everyone until all the flocks are gathered, whether for convenience or consideration to others or just too big for one person to open or whatever, but that's what they would do. And so Rachel is coming, obviously, at the same time because this is their daily practice. And he sees her, and then what does he do? He goes and he opens the well. He rolls the stone away from the entrance. Now, what's interesting about that? Yeah, here we've read thus far, he is the stay-at-home type. He's the domestic type. You think Esau would be the one who would have been strong enough to just roll this thing off on his own if that was the case. And yet here Jacob just does it. I don't know. I don't know why he was able to do that. Maybe it was just adrenaline. Maybe he's trying to impress the girl and found a little bit of extra oomph. Maybe it was, a Samson type thing where he was filled with the strength of the Lord. Like, I don't know. But for whatever reason, he is able to open this well. And I think certainly there was something in there about possibly wanting to try and impress this beautiful woman that he had just met, and maybe trying to show that he was a man of action, try to show that he was a man of courtesy towards women or those who were needing help. And so he opens the well. And then what does he do besides that? Okay, he kisses her and he weeps aloud. Why would he do that? Okay, joy for one thing. Yeah, he's. This is the way that you would greet someone at the time, obviously, especially a close relative that you haven't seen, either in a long time or in his case, ever. But just joy, an expression of joy and welcoming, and to one's relative, and just that he had found her, you know, and that his journey was complete, that God had blessed him, all those things. And so he tells her that he is her kinsman, that he is Rebekah's son specifically. And then what does she do? She runs to tell her father. All right. So then what? How does Laban greet Jacob? He runs to meet him. And he kisses him. So we have the same thing. We have the same kind of... So and obviously, this first kiss of Jacob to Rachel was not anything romantic. It's just a familial greeting. And the same way that Laban runs and kisses him, brought him into his house, and Jacob told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, "Surely you are bone of my bone. Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him a month. Now, why would he have said, "Surely you are my bone and flesh"? It may have been the only truthful thing he ever said. Well, it'd be easy for anyone to just walk up and say, "Hey, I'm your relative that you've never met," right? To me, and this really has no significance, I don't guess, but it seems to me like he could see the familial resemblance. You know, he runs and meets him, kisses him, says, "Yeah, like, surely you are my sister's son. I can tell just by looking at you. And so, of course, I'm going to welcome you into my home." Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe that's why he says that. I don't know. And so then he says in verse 15, Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?" So this is after a month of being there. And basically, and again, Laban actually says something correctly. He's like, "Well, you know, just because you're my relative, I'm not going to make you work for nothing. I'm not going to make you work for free," which is also correct. It's the right thing to do. So he says, "Okay, name your price." And what is Jacob's response? "Okay, well, I will serve you for your younger daughter, Rachel. I will serve you for 7 years." Which I find, what is interesting about the fact that Jacob offers to serve for 7 years in order to obtain her? And you compare that to, for instance, Isaac and Rebekah. Yeah, Jacob didn't have anything to offer. The servant went with gifts, you know, tons of you know, valuable jewelry and whatever else to offer as gifts. And that was kind of the bride price, right? It would have been traditional to pay a bride price. And Jacob doesn't have anything to offer. And so, other than himself, other than his own work. And so that's what he has to do. And then the same thing is going to happen, right? At the end of that 7 years, he still has nothing to offer because he's been paying for the first one. He hasn't been receiving anything for his work. And so then once again, he ends up being trapped into, well, if I want her, I don't really have a choice other than to abide. And the thing is, well, it would have been an insult for him to work any less of a time for the younger daughter than the older daughter. And so he was trapped. Didn't have much choice. If he wanted Rachel, this is what he had to do. And so he names his price, though, and Laban agrees. He says, "The better I should give her to you than any other man," which makes sense, right? He's family. It's kind of the way things worked back then. And so they agreed. All right, so question number 10, how does this compare to the selection of Rebekah for Isaac? I mean, it's similar in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, there's no deception, obviously, you know, at this moment in time, at least it doesn't seem. I don't know when the cogs started turning in Laban's head. You know, he had 7 years to think about it and to plan his deception. But the other thing I would say is different is that with Isaac, when the servant got there and he found Rebekah, he literally only stayed one night and he turned around and left with her. Whereas here, Jacob's having to stay, you know, initially for 7 years. And again, the difference of the servant going versus Jacob himself going. Okay, Clint, and then Tim. Yep, 7 years is a long time to work for a singular goal and to keep your word about that. Yeah, absolutely, Tim. Yeah, certainly there's God's providence, you know, at work. And, you know, I wonder too, like, you see a little bit of a parallel. I don't know if this is a stretch or not, but, you know, with the Jews under the Old Testament, the Mosaic Law, coming to God, they're offering, what do they do to obtain their righteousness? What do they do to obtain salvation? They're offering their own works of righteousness under the law. They're you know, what do I have? Here's what I have to offer. Whereas with us under Christ, what do we have to offer? Nothing. Like, you know, and so Jacob's sort of coming more in that sense of an allegory towards Christianity, where I have nothing to offer but my service, you know. But labor, yeah, exactly. Okay, question number 11, describe Jacob's love for Rachel. Right. 7 years seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. It was nothing. Again, I mean, that's 7 years, a long time. Maybe less so to him, but and then maybe, you know, with their longer lifespans, but still. That would have been a long time, and yet it seemed to him as nothing. And why did he love Rachel instead of Leah? That's the only thing that's mentioned specifically, is that she was prettier. I mean, that's men for you, right? Here we go. What does it say about Leah in comparison? Yes, so verse 17, Leah's eyes were weak or soft, but Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. Who knows? It could have something to do with her personality. Yeah, yeah, seeing her would have been helpful. And maybe part of it is just because she's the first one he laid eyes on, and he knew about her character because, like I said, she's a shepherd. She's like, wow, you know, this is, she's the go-getter. Like, that's the one, that's the kind of woman I want. I don't know. Did I hear something over here? Yeah. Yep, so maybe he learned a little bit about the wives of Esau and said, oh, well, I don't want women that are like that. One interesting thing my commentary noted about this is that this is an instance of where a marriage occurs because of romance, right? He loved her. The love with which he had was, you know, it made 7 years seem like a few days. I mean, that's a love story, right? And yet his mother had been married in a completely arranged situation. And so you see both in the Bible. You see both romantic marriages as well as arranged marriages existing in the Bible, and neither one seems to be preferred over the other. They just simply are, and you know, both are. You can make both work, right? So I thought that was an interesting point to bring up. The other thing he asked, question number 12, what can we learn about weddings from this story? Huh? Absolutely nothing. Okay, well, I don't know about that. Yeah, if she's wearing a veil, you might want to take it off before you say I do. Make sure it's the right one. That's, yeah, lesson number one, yeah. Very good. Point taken. So the other thing, I was okay, I guess maybe the reason he's bringing this, because I've actually seen this question asked, and had someone ask this question of me, like, well, what does it take to constitute a marriage? Like, if I just want to just declare my love to someone and say, let's get married, do we have to go to the courthouse? Do we have to have witnesses? Or, you know, can we just, well, we say our vows before God, you know, and that constitutes marriage. Well, does it? Can it? Is there some, like, actual process that needs to be gone through? Okay. Okay, you're making a covenant and consummation, okay. Yeah, I think that's kind of the big number three, or three C's, right? There's culture, there's covenant, and there's consummation. I think you got to have all three. You can't just say, oh, walk up to, you know, somebody that you've been dating and be like, hey, let's be married, and then just, boom, there you go. Like, no, there's a process. Now, that process may vary by culture, but here in this instance, obviously, there was a betrothal period. There was a bride price paid. There was a public ceremony and feast and party. And then, you know, before he went into her and was given formally by the father. So I think that we see that there has to be this cultural and legal process that has to be followed. You can't just say, you know, like Michael Scott in The Office, I declare bankruptcy. Like, you can't just say it. Nobody probably got that reference at all. Man, y'all are either too old or too young in here. My wife got it, so. That's right. Yeah, and the law of the land says this is what constitutes a marriage. You have to get a license. You have to go, you know, the minister, whatever, the rest of the peace or whoever is authorized has to sign on the marriage certificate. All those things have to be gone through. So, basically, I think that kind of thinking is just a runaround for people that just want to have sex outside of marriage. You know, that's basically all it is. Yeah, you have presented yourself as such. But you didn't go through the legal process. But that's still, that's why there's such a thing as common law marriage.
So, I mean, that's why I can't be a little.
But yeah. Sure. Okay. All right, so when the wedding occurred, how did Laban deceive Jacob? And legitimate question, right? He says, think, why didn't Jacob realize he had the wrong woman? I think there's a lot of reasons. Clearly, Laban went to some great lengths to achieve this deception, just as his sister did. And there's a lot of ways, you know, that they could have done this, whether it had been getting him drunk. I mean, look at Lot, Noah, all right, you know, both get drunk, you know, and have no idea what's going on. And so I think what this tells us is that Leah was in on it. Yeah. Somebody's holding Rachel back somewhere, you know. So where's she at? Why isn't she fighting, you know, to be like, hey, it's not me, I'm over here. He probably would have done it. It would have been worth it to him. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, okay. Maybe a little bit of just testing him. I mean, you know, obviously, as far as him not realizing it, I mean, it could have just been the darkness, could have been the veil. She could have been, you know, whispering so as to not reveal her voice as, you know, obviously that was the one thing Isaac did recognize is like, hey, you know, you seem like you're Esau, but I hear the voice of Jacob. Yeah. Yeah, they probably looked similar in you know, when covered as she would have been. So there's all it's certainly very possible for them to have pulled off this deception, but everybody basically had to be in on it except for Jacob. But again, just note the irony, right? Of here the deceiver getting a taste of his own medicine and becoming the one who is deceived. He had treated his father and you know, in the same way, and now he is receiving the same kind of treatment. Pratt says, doubtless this similarity smote Jacob's heart as he pondered what had been done. He certainly got a taste of his own medicine. He was reaping as he had sown, and he did not like it a bit. He recognized it for what it was, deceit. And he confronted Laban with it. Now, if what Laban did was so wrong, then why would anyone try and justify what Jacob himself had done? And so certainly, you know, there's that principle that is very biblical of reaping what you sow, right? That's shown here. He goes on to say, perhaps this similarity may be why Jacob did not react more strongly than he did. Perhaps he saw the indirect retribution for his own misconduct. One almost wonders if God, while surely not approving of Laban's act, yet permitted it to teach Jacob a lesson. In any case, there can be no doubt that Jacob suffered the effects of other people's deceit here and repeatedly throughout his life. It can only be hoped that he learned the folly of deceit till he was sick of it. What a price to pay. Through all of this, it becomes clear that God was humbling Jacob to develop in him the qualities needed in one who had received the blessings promised to Abraham. I can think of no case after this in which Jacob deceived or deliberately wronged others except that he played favorites among his sons. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. He became the one who was deceived. All right, and so what does Jacob say to Laban? Why have you deceived me in this way? He recognized it for what it was. I served you for Rachel, and yet you have given me Leah. And note one other irony here. The ESV notes, Jacob's... Having deceived his father by pretending to be the firstborn, Jacob himself is now deceived by his uncle Laban into marrying his firstborn daughter. So it's not just deception. It's deception about the firstborn. Wow. Quite the irony. So afterward, Laban permits Jacob to marry Rachel, but only on the understanding that he will work for another 7 years. So quite a bit of irony here in this story. And then what is Laban's excuse for all this? Well, it's not our custom to give away the younger first. Well, you should have said that 7 years ago, if that was actually the case. Now, whether this was a lie or not, who knows? But he certainly could have been more forthcoming. He certainly had ample opportunity. And so clearly, what is Laban's whole thing here? What is he really after?
4 years.
Yeah, free labor, 7 more years. Get something for nothing. Here he is. He's getting the best of both worlds. He is marrying off both of his daughters to someone who he trusts, and he's getting 14 years worth of free labor for it, essentially. He's got to be figuring, well, even if this doesn't go well, at the very least, you know, I get both of them married off. Yep. Okay, yeah, I mean, he knew that this is probably something about the blessings of God going along with this. He's putting his daughters in a good situation. Yep. Yes. Yeah, so and maybe that's part of what he saw is like, man, over these 7 years, he sees, wow, I'm being really blessed because Jacob, and he's actually going to say that later on. He said, you know, and Jacob's going to say, hey, look, you know that you've been blessed because of me. And so he's saying, well, I would like a little bit more of that, please. And so he finds a way to take advantage of it. And so in all of this, we see a lot of very poor conduct on the part of Laban, I think also on the part of Leah, and the fact that she went along with it and certainly had a role to play. Yeah. Yeah. How could you love this woman who deceived you into marrying her? I mean, I think that would be very, very difficult to get over. And we see that in his lack of desire to have relations with her over time. Okay. All right, and what about Rachel in all of this? I think I would call her a victim. You know, she didn't have any say in any of this, and yet she's suffering the consequences of other people's poor behavior and choices. And it seems like she had no control whatsoever. All right. So what all does this lead to? What problems does this arrangement lead to? Jealousy, vindictiveness between the sisters, strife between husband and wives, all kinds of problems, as we're going to see. And interestingly, Jacob, I think was godly enough to recognize and fulfill his responsibilities as a husband towards Leah. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't still going to show favorites, right? Because that's what he seems to do. What do we see him doing as the rest of his life progresses? Okay, yeah, so he shows favoritism towards Rachel and towards her son Joseph when he does eventually come along. And again, following in his mother's footsteps, right? She showed favoritism towards him. Now he's showing favoritism towards her. The same things get passed on, apparently, in this family. Those character traits just go right on down the line. And so Jacob favors Rachel. Clearly, this situation created a lot of problems. Clearly, polygamy is not in God's plan, although he allows it here. It just creates competition and conflict and comparison. And you have to wonder, like, what were the arrangements for where did he sleep every night, right? I mean, it clearly seems like he spent most of his time with Rachel. As we're going to see in the next chapter, that's how does Leah obtain a night with Jacob? Do you remember the name? Yes, the Mandrakes. That's right. So she hires him, basically. In order to get a night with him, she has to hire him. That doesn't sound very good. And yet that's the situation that they find themselves in. Yep. Oh, yeah, always selling something, right? that's where we find ourselves. And so he loved Rachel more than Leah, verse 30. And so he served Laban for another 7 years. And the other thing that I find interesting, in my head when I was a kid, I always thought that, like, I guess just I wasn't reading it carefully or people weren't explaining it carefully, but I always thought, well, he worked 7 years, he had Leah, then he had to work another 7 years, and then he got Rachel. No, he only had to do 1 week with Leah, and then he got her, and then he had to, you know, pay retroactively. Right, so he worked another 7 years. So Leah literally had 1 week, you know, a honeymoon week, if you will, before he was then given Rachel. I mean, that I think probably made the situation all the worse. Yeah, she knew that her husband still did not really care for her, at least in the same way that he did for Rachel, despite their being together over these years. And so, you know, Leah, of course, God looks at this. He blesses Leah instead, sort of as a comfort. And she is the one who bears sons. She has Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Reuben means see a son. Simeon means heard. Levi means attached. And Judah means praise. So all of these are, every time she bears a son, she basically says, oh, now, surely he'll love me now because I've given him a son. Now he's going to, look, see a son. Okay, now God has heard me. Oh, attached. So now he'll be attached to me. He'll finally give me the affection that I desire because I've given him a son. And then finally with Judah, she's praising God. But, you know, it's just interesting the way that all this unfolds. Now, I will conclude by saying this. Of all of the badness that's going on here, what is the one good thing that comes out of all this that we see God's providence working? They're starting to multiply, right? How do you give a man a lot of children really fast? Multiple women. So despite it not being ideal, you see God's providence working in that this promise to Abraham begins now finally to be fulfilled because, right, Abraham only had the one son. Isaac only had the two sons. Technically Abraham had two, but whatever. The one promised son, the one line for this line, and then now finally they're starting to multiply. But in any case, I see a little bit of God's providence there in making good out of the bad in this situation. Okay, we'll pick up with chapter 30 next week. Thank you.